Running with Jake, the podcast.
So let me get this straight. We are on the Lovejoy Hour to tell people about our show, our podcast.
That's exactly what's going on, yes.
This is great. I can't think of anybody else's show I would rather be on talking about our show. We've got less than 60 seconds. We need to crack on.
Let's not tell everybody about how great Tim Lovejoy is because people know that already, right? Because they're listening. You got to tell them about our podcast.
So if you fancy listening to something a little bit different, we are Running with Jake, the podcast. Yes, we are a show about running and fitness and mental wellness, but we do like to have a bit of fun as well. We like to have a bit of a laugh. We keep things very real. I think that's pretty fair to say.
We do keep it real. And sometimes, just sometimes, I think we share too much.
You definitely overshare.
So, it's Running with Jake, the podcast. That's our show, and that's our time up.
Give it a listen. You never know. You might just like it. Welcome to the Lovejoy Hour, sponsored by Cooker, 100-degree boiling hot water straight to your kitchen tap. Mine does chilled filtered water and chilled sparkling filtered water too. It is a great invention. For more information, go to cooker.co.uk. Today's hour, I get curious about working from home or working solo. I've worked on my own for a long time now, and I'm not sure I ever get used to it. I just like being around people, like all of us, I suppose, though it seems... Because of the pandemic and in the future, because it's convenient and there's the tech now in place, I think more people will work on their own from home. And Rebecca Seale has written a book all about this, Solo, How to Work Alone and Not Lose Your Mind. Rebecca Seale is a journalist and TV presenter and an author. You might best know her from coming on Sunday Brunch as one of the drink and food experts. She comes on all the time and has been ever since we've been doing the show on Channel 4. She's written loads of books about food too. And as I say, she's written this book all about working on your own. Let's meet her. Here's Rebecca Seale. Rebecca, welcome to the podcast. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for having me.
Pleasure. We'll get into your book soon. But first of all, I suppose we should ask what you actually do for a job. I know you turn up on Sunday Brunch every now and then after you've written another book or you're educating us about food. But what is it you do?
I'm a journalist, I guess, is the best way of describing me. That's what I've done most and for longest. But I also sometimes say I'm just a hired hand. I write stuff for people, and I'll write about whatever as long as it's interesting. I think that's my main skill, is kind of making ideas accessible for people. So I could be doing that about anything, and I have done it about all sorts of different random things. As it happened, the majority of what I ended up doing was around food and drink, but I often think that was more luck. I was grafting to get work, but it was luck that that happened to end up being in food. And then I happened to fall in love with it.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because I've known you for how many years do you think it is now? We've known each other.
It's about 10, actually.
10 years. And I'd never bothered Googling you before, so I did. Turns out you've got an MA in International Peace and Security from King's College London. And a BSc in International Relations from the London School of Economics. That's pretty impressive stuff.
Thank you.
What did you set out to do? I mean, what is peace and security? What does that mean? Peace and security.
So after I'd done International Relations, which I kind of just did because it allows you to do a lot of different things at once and get a degree. It's a bit like doing kind of internationally biased general studies, but harder. And so after I'd done that, I was a bit lost, frankly, and I was working in a restaurant and I couldn't seem to get anyone to give me a job or an internship or work experience. And I didn't have any connections, don't come from a family that's got a lot of kind of connections. My parents are social workers, so I didn't have any ways in to anything, it felt like. And so the next step I decided to take would be doing an MA, which I actually haven't, or is it an MSc? Well, anyway, whatever it is. No, it's an MA.
I don't know the difference. I didn't even go to university.
They're sort of pointless distinctions, I think. Anyway, so I did it because I wanted a job. I needed a job. And I kept being told that I needed more qualifications than I already had in order to get into what I thought I wanted to do, which was working in international organisations. And so I did it. And I've never used it. I've never used my degree or the second one in real terms. I mean, they taught me how to think and research and read and, you know, write to a certain extent, but I've never used the actual stuff that I've learned. Not for a second have I ever used it. So it's felt like quite an expensive year, frankly.
Well, I wonder actually, because we're going to get on to talking about working solo, and I wonder if you spend enough time in education and doing what the sort of things that you did, whether you learn to self-motivate. That's one of the things to actually get those sort of qualifications. You have to learn to do that, I imagine.
Yeah, that's true. And I think it's funny, a lot of the time when I talk about solo working at the moment, I feel as though people have reverted to student life, you know, especially people who are younger and have been forced into working from home and are working from their bedroom. The picture I always have of people doing that is the picture I had of myself, you know, with a desk next to a bed, and that sort of impossibility of escaping work and your own expectations and all that stuff. And I found that really difficult and really messy. And I actually ended up in counselling halfway through my LSE degree because I just got completely befuddled and unhappy and panicky and overstressed, and it was not a very, I didn't have a very good time. I mean, LSE is a great university, but I didn't have a particularly brilliant time there. I made really good friends, but I think the sort of mental health implications of being somewhere where you have to achieve like really, really high results all the time is quite massive. So I think I did learn a lot, but it was probably a bit of a trial by fire.
I always worry about students. You know, obviously, you know, my twins, Grace and Rose, They're quite academic and they did very well in there. They've always done very well, unlike their dad.
I think you're doing all right.
Well, no, I mean, like in education terms, they're doing very well. But I always watched them go through that stress and I thought no one would be allowed to put a work people, employees through that form of stress.
Yeah.
The idea that it builds up to one day is, I've always found ludicrous, especially as you know that some people are good at exams, some people aren't. So it's not a massive, you know, it's not a great indicator. It's an indicator of sorts of people who can handle the pressure and build up to that one exam. But also I thought during the pandemic, it would be a really good opportunity, because our education's all over the place, to actually have a rethink and a reset about it all. And because I think if you speak to teachers and you speak to students and everyone who's been through it, it's not a particularly nice experience. My youngest daughter skips into school because she loves it. And by the time you get to secondary school, you hate it because the pressure's too big.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think two things. One thing I would say about what you just said in terms of your academic kind of work or not, is that I've often thought this about you. Given the number of people that you've interviewed, you must know more stuff than anyone with any degree at all. Like, you know, because all you do when you go to university is listen to people telling you things and read stuff about it. And you're doing exactly that, but for like a far greater period of time. So I arguably, that's much more interesting and valuable, isn't it, than like a narrow 3-year long focus. I'm not trying to blow smoke, but you know what I mean.
No, I've got something to admit to you at this early stage. When you came on the show and you were going to talk about your book on the show, I read your book and then I can't remember what I did with it. So I asked you to send me another one. And it was only last night I picked it up and I realized that I've forgotten it all. I know the gist of it and I remember it, but I can't remember any of the facts and figures. So I think, and I honestly had this conversation in my head last night thinking what I must do is I must have information which I only retain for a very short period of time whilst I interview someone, then, because I interview so many people in the podcast and Sunday brunch, and then I let it go, and then if they come back to me I'm like, I have no idea what we discussed, but I'm sure it's good. So you're gonna have to help me through this. No, I know roughly what we're talking
isn't that different to a degree either, because if you ask me about, I mean, part of what I studied, for example, I wrote my dissertation on genocide in Rwanda and post-conflict justice and reconciliation in South Africa. Wow. And Yugoslavia, yeah, like massive subjects. I can remember only the barest threads of what I knew at that point. It's exactly the same. And actually, I think it's just a journalistic skill, because it happens to me all the time when I work on articles. You know, I can do something about, I did something a year or two ago about parents of vegan children, just looking at kind of whether it worked, whether it was a viable option as a way of feeding children for The Guardian. I can't remember a stat. You know, that was only a couple of years ago. So maybe it's just a journalism thing, and you're just doing exactly, we're both just doing the same thing, just gathering maybe what we need and then shedding it.
I went, my daughters went to look at Cambridge University. They didn't go. They didn't go to Cambridge or Oxford, but they went there, and I think they wanted me to go just to see what I thought about them going to somewhere like that. I went into a couple of the lectures and I thought, this is absolutely amazing. I would have been in my element. I went to an anthropology lecture and I went to, I think it was a history lecture. And both of them, I was like, I love this. They're just talking crap like I do all day long about rubbish. And I was like, you know, one was about money and I loved it, all about the Brixton pound and, you know, what makes value money valuable and stuff like that. And I can't remember what the other one was about. The other one was about I can't remember now. It was about borders or something. And I was like, I love this. And I'm going to my daughters, you've got to go here. It's amazing. This is like my dream, just to sit around and talk crap with people all day long. And interestingly, I'm not sure my daughter's having the greatest time at university at the moment, either of them. But they're both studying history and politics. And I do notice, even though they don't like it because of the pandemic and everything, they are politically and historically engaged constantly. And I think that's a really interesting thing, that they keep quoting philosophy at me and politics and stuff like that. And I think it must be great to be having that knowledge. So I didn't get myself an education, but I think I would have quite enjoyed it. I blame myself. Yeah. Bloody score. So how did you go from getting a great education like that to being a food writer then?
So I was lucky enough to get an internship at the Evening Standard. And then a new editor came into the Evening Standard and fired absolutely everybody that I knew, which at that moment I thought was the worst thing that had ever happened to me, not realizing that they would then all go and get jobs at other places. I just thought I had like this one shot at having a contact anywhere. And then one of the editors I'd worked for ended up at The Observer, being the editor of Observer Food Monthly. And I went and did another internship for her for about 6 months, working in a restaurant at night to pay my way, and doing 5 days a week there. And then finally managed to get like the most junior job on the magazine. And I was there for 6 years. And by the time I left, I was a contributing editor on that magazine and another one. And then The Guardian, Observer as a whole, offered every single member of staff voluntary redundancy at the moment of the financial crash, or just after. And so I jumped at it, because at that point I had no responsibilities, no mortgage, no children, just a little rental place. And so I could risk it. And I had just about enough money for a few months worth of life if I didn't earn anything. And it flew from there. Which was great in some ways, although from the book you maybe know that I, after about 6 years of really, really hard work to try and establish myself, I kind of had a bit of not a breakdown, more like a burnout moment, where I just suddenly realised I was really miserable again and had no life and was just working and wasn't doing anything else at all.
So how did you get from starting doing that stuff to ending up on Sunday Brunch? Where was that in the timeline?
I was scouted. Do you not know this story? Do you not know that I never knew that I was going on Sunday Brunch?
No, probably,
I never told you. So I was scouted for something or other, and I had no idea what, by somebody when you moved over from the BBC to Channel 4. And so I was brought in to see Chris, the producer at the time, just to have a chat with him. And it was all confidential and nobody would tell me what it was or anything. So I screen tested and I did, you know, various little bits, and nobody would tell me what it was. And then I heard nothing for about 2 weeks. And I just thought, that's not going to happen. Whatever it was, it's not going to happen. And then I got a phone call on a Wednesday and they were like, you've got the expert job as the drinks expert. And I was like, on what though? And they were like, Sunday Brunch. It's the new version of something for the weekend. You're starting on Sunday. And I was like, what are you, what? I honestly had absolutely no idea. Absolutely none. They'd kept it so confidential. I didn't know I was going to be working with you. I didn't know anything about, I had no idea. I'd never met Simon. I had no idea, no clue. And I swear that first time that I was on with you, I genuinely was holding onto the edge of the counter. I mean, my hands feel shaky just thinking about it, trying not to be sick, because I'd had like 4 days to get used to the idea of being on live telly. They hadn't told me anything. I thought if it was anything, it would be like a cable, nothingy, you know, something. Because I'd never done any telly before. I'd never, ever, ever anything. I'd always been a print journalist. So I just had, my mind was so blown. I remember those 4 days just being absolute terror.
Oh, that's absolute brilliant.
Absolute terror. So I had no clue.
From our perspective, you were brilliant. You arrived and you were like, because we were like, who's this person going to work with us? And then you were just, you arrived and you just delivered on day one. And so it became the public, the viewers loved you, didn't they? Or loved you, because you still come on the show. But what was it like to suddenly go from print to TV and people know you like that?
Oh, it's so weird. I went from having like 700 Twitter followers to having 22,000 about a year later, which is not like a massive number, but it was still for me and in my world, that's enormous. Like it was just so weird. I don't know. I mean, I didn't get recognised that much, or I feel as though more what happened, and maybe you have this, people would just look at me like in the supermarket, or like just a frowny sort of, who is that? Like, I wasn't well enough known for anyone to be like, oh my God, it's at all. But people would just think, do I know her? Does she live on my road? Or do I? Yeah. So
about your industry? What did they think of it? All the other writers? Because obviously it's a great gig when you can get a TV show, isn't it? Because suddenly your value goes up more.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think people were broadly supportive. I didn't know that many people in the drinks writing world at that point. So I don't know if they were all cursing me. And they've been polite subsequently. So I'm not sure. I can imagine there were people who thought there were better people in terms of experience and qualification, because at that point I was only about, what would I have been, 30, 29, something like that. So I was quite young to be kind of billed as an expert. But I just took it as an opportunity to learn everything I could about each thing each week. And then, like you say, I'd sort of jettison the information. So now I couldn't, if you said to me, talk to me about tequila, I'd be like,
it's about knowledge, but it's all also with TV, where entertainment is about communication as well. And you have to have the ability to take the knowledge and communicate it well. And we've often had people, experts on our show who just are boring because they know everything but they don't know how to communicate it to us. Talk too much, they, you know, they want to get their point across. And you know, obviously we took the mickey a bit out, I had a laugh with you, had a joke around with you, and you loved it when that happened, because like, oh great, I don't have to remember my facts now, I can just have a laugh.
So true. I was always happy if I got 3 facts out. That was always my aim, was if I could do 3. But I mean, some of the funniest ones that I remember the most clearly were ones where I got no opportunity to talk about what I was supposed to be talking about, but ended up having, like, I had an argument with one of the Spice Girls about the right kind of glass to drink champagne out of. And I was like, how far am I going to take this? Like, in my head, like, how many of these, like, broadcast minutes am I going to use up having an argument with Sporty Spice about glassware? Like, so weird.
So then we're going to get into talking about solo, but then you start writing books. Was that, I mean, was that off the back of all the articles and obviously having a TV profile, they came in and offered it to you, or did you go around pitching it?
What, solo or the cookbooks?
Well, no, all the cookbooks you did for...
The cookbooks I started just before the telly, I think. Yeah, so I think I'd done 1 or 2 just before I started working with you. And then the next ones, the ones that I did with the Leon Restaurant Group, they came after. I've been doing those for about 5 years now. I think they were quite separate, actually. I think I just had a reputation as a sort of a pretty solid pair of hands, like I would deliver what people needed. I mean, I think the trick to being a good freelance writer is just delivering on the deadline. That's it. That's really, you don't really have to do anything else.
What do you love about food then? By the way, I'll go through some of the books: Lisbon, Recipes from the Heart of Portugal, Postcards from Greece, the Greenwich Market Cookbook, Istanbul, Recipes from the Heart of Turkey. So there's a distinct sort of food you like, isn't there, I suppose?
Yeah.
Region of the world.
But, yeah. I was actually...
God.
No, sorry. I was going to say I was actually meant to do a cookbook about food in Beirut just as the beginning of the Arab Spring happened. And I still hope that I'll be able to get over and do that. But it's never been safe enough, sadly, for us to do that kind of project there over a sort of really long period of time.
What is it you love about food then?
So it was interesting that you mentioned anthropology earlier, because I guess I sort of see food and drink to a certain extent as a way of understanding different cultures and our own culture. Like it's just a way in. It almost doesn't matter that it's food. I mean, it's nice that it's food because it's joyful and it's a pleasurable experience. And I like cooking. I love cooking. I love the sort of meditative process of it. But the biggest thing, the most important thing for me was always about what it told me about people. That was the only bit that counted when it came to answering the kind of why am I doing this over the really long term. Was because if you ask somebody about the food that they eat, they will invite you into their home. I mean, that happened when I was doing those books in Lisbon and Istanbul and Greece all the time. You'd say, how do you make this? Now, well, what you need to do is come around on Sunday and I will show you, or my mum will show you. I mean, I had lunches in gardens where people would translate their mum telling me about how to make this particular fish dish with this particular fish and this particular herb. And there's like, I don't know, it's an expression of culture, it's an expression of love, it's an expression of tradition. You can see the thread that runs back through a culture. I just loved all of that. I never get bored of it.
Well, I think that's fascinating, and I agree with you. I'm just not that interested in food per se, but I love everything which goes around with it. So yeah. I also love the social side of yeah. meals, and I really struggle when I go to a restaurant and it's all about the food, as in it's Michelin starred or something. And that's a real generalization, because some of the Michelin starred restaurants have got great atmospheres and fantastic yeah. food. But when I say that, I think people can 14 people making an inch of cod, you know, it's like, Jesus Christ, how boring. Whereas you want to go into a restaurant and have an experience where you feel like you're somewhere and you can have a social experience and enjoy the company of the people and also feel a part of the culture of the restaurant. I think that's really important, and that's why that's what I love about food. And Simon at the moment's interestingly on Sunday brunch has decided to go down the road of making good hearty food because we're in a pandemic, and I honestly, the food he's making is delicious, but you can see in every dish it's like you could sit down with a family. He always says put it in the middle and everyone helps yeah. themselves. That's the sort of food I love.
Yeah, yeah. And I love restaurants that do that. I love restaurants where it's, you know, it's in the middle or it's shared, or I don't know, there's just I only went out for a few meals last year, but I remember the conviviality and the power of that thing of being around a table with other people. Like I remember those meals, the 2020 meals, much more profoundly than any probably that have gone before, because they meant so much more emotionally because they were so rare and special. I think food has a really profound role to play in society and
also in families as well, and friendship groups and things, but definitely families. My parents, the one thing I think they did which I loved was they always made us eat dinner together. I hated it at the time. I didn't want to sit with my bloody brother and mum and dad and eat. I wanted to watch telly, but they made us always family meals. We had to sit down at a table together every evening, and I've followed that through with my children. And I just think it's what there was a stat the other day on something I was listening to. I can't remember what, a radio show or something, where they said 60% of people eat their dinner in front of the television. And I was like, wow, that's the one time that, you know, my mum would sit down and go, right, what have you all been up to these days? And my house, there's no mobile phones, you know, there's nothing, like, you've got to sit and have a conversation. You know, how long does a meal last? Half an hour a day. That's it. That's an important time, I think, to come together.
Yeah, and it's a skill. Well, I was going to say it's a rare skill. It's becoming rare, but it's a skill which we need to have and we'll need to have in life as adults. Like, I think it's really scary, the idea that there could be people leaving home in sort of 10 years' time who wouldn't know how to sit down and have a meal with other people, like, because they'd hardly done that in their family lives and wouldn't have that art of conversation and conviviality and socialising. Yeah, like leaving aside the sadness of people not knowing how to cook, which I just think is one of the best ways of expressing love for yourself and love for other people, but not knowing how to sit around a table and talk, that's even worse, isn't it? That's desperate.
TV is too good. It's too addictive. I'm trying to regular listeners to the podcast, and I'm trying not to have a Netflix addiction, because you can just lose hours and hours now, especially in this pandemic, of just going, what's the next one I watch? What's the next series I watch? And I start getting into French subtitled things and everything. And I'm sort of trying my hardest not to do it now. I have a lot of football on in the background, and I'm trying to read more and just try and do different things. Otherwise, the TV's too good. That's the problem. Yeah. We know what it is. It gives us a little bit of emotional tourism. We can go into a television screen and enjoy some emotions by watching something, and it's nice, but maybe neglecting our own by doing it. Right, let's go on to your book, Solo: How to Work Alone and Not Lose Your Mind. We can come back to food, because I think that's an important part of working on your own, which we'll do later. But why did you decide to write this book? It's clear, I think you've told us earlier that you spent a lot of time working on your own in the end.
Yeah, so I had about 6 years completely by myself. I mean, broadly speaking, I work alone still now, but 6 years on my own and just not really doing anything else, head down, you know, working at the weekends because I was doing stuff with you guys, and not really, I don't know if you managed to take time off in the week to compensate for the fact that you work the weekends, but I couldn't, because I just felt like I was too early in my career, and I was too sort of, I felt really vulnerable to not grabbing every moment. And I just, after about 6 years, woke up and thought, this is miserable. I'm not enjoying this. And I felt really guilty for feeling miserable as well, because I felt really ashamed that I wasn't taking pleasure in this kind of incredible privilege opportunity. I went looking for help. I went looking for a book to read to try and figure out, you know, how to get through this sticky period. And I couldn't really find anything. And there's more resources now for people who work by themselves, but at that point, there wasn't a lot. So I sort of realized, oh God, I'm going to have to write a book. I'm going to have to do this. Like, I'm good at bringing information together and putting it in one place and making it kind of, understandable. That's my skill. So I'll have to do it in this case. It took a few years because I had kids. I was having IVF at the time, and then I had kids. And that's quite hard to write books at the same time as. So I started writing it in 2019. So it's actually got nothing to do with the pandemic. And most of it was written before lockdown.
I'm just picking up on a few of your words there. It's really interesting. Ashamed and guilty. That's all the emotions that I feel constantly. From working at home, I'm like much like yourself. I did soccer AM for 11 years, where I was in an office with guys and girls all day long, chatting away and trying to do stuff. To then relocating to my home, and we didn't have Zoom and stuff, you know, and I had all sorts of different jobs. And the idea of not working on a Monday or a Tuesday because I'd worked the weekend is so alien to me. I'd feel guilt and I'd feel ashamed, and not that I want to do that sort of thing. And someone would say, do you want to play golf? And I go, oh no, it's a work day. I've got to do something. And even though I had nothing to do, I'd still feel that, you know, it's built into me that I work 6 days a week, or, you know, I recently I've been able to be better at handling that. But for a long time, it's like, I've always worked 6 days a week, 7 days a week. You know, I have to do that. But then when you throw in the family side of things as well, which you have done, you know, when you leave the house and go and sit in an office from 9 to 5, you can't do family stuff then, because you're in an office. If you're at home, you can. So those words, ashamed and guilty, they just come up so often, I think, with people working at home.
Yeah, you're completely right. And it's a real, you get into a real tangle, I think, because you get this kind of, this really painful combination of feeling guilty about everything. Like, I'd feel guilty about how much I was working or not working. Was I working too much or too little? Then I'd feel guilty about whether I was earning enough. And I'd feel guilty about whether I was putting my career too much on the back burner when the kids came along. And then I'd feel guilty about whether I was neglecting them. Because, like, I went back to work, you know, you don't get much maternity pay when you're freelance. And at that point, I wasn't earning that much. So I couldn't really afford to be on maternity leave for a long time. So I think I went back to work after about 12 weeks after my first child. So she was literally on a mat at my feet, and I'd be standing at the counter doing recipes or typing. And that's a great privilege in some ways, because I could, but it's awful at the same time, because I wasn't, you know, better from having had a baby and having IVF and all that kind of stuff. So it was like, it was a really tough time, and the emotional kind of levels were all over the place. I think I went back on the show after about 6 weeks, actually.
Yeah, you were on pretty long. Early. Yeah. I mean, they might not be changing the education system, but the workplace has definitely changed from the pandemic. There's definitely been a reset there where people have realized, I mean, even if you just get ill, I imagine your boss now will say, you can do it from home today on Zoom. We don't want you in the office to
infect
the rest of the people. So even just that side of things. But I think there'll also be a element of people going, okay, you can take the Friday off or something, but you've got to work from home, we'll Zoom you. So there's going to be a lot more people now. I think we'll migrate back to offices, don't you? Because I think it's
really interesting. There's so much research going on about that at the moment, and I'm waiting to be sent a new study on exactly that, about kind of whether you can collaborate at a distance or whether it kind of affects people's ability to work efficiently. There's such a mixture of information coming out. I think that some things have happened which will make it very hard to go back to the office 100%. One of those is that so many people have moved out of the kind of big financial centres and the big kind of work centres. So if you think about the number of people that have left London and moved to the coast, their expectation is that they will work in an office 1 or 2 days a week, but they're not intending to come back 5 days a week.
So you're saying they've moved out since the pandemic?
Yeah. Yeah.
Have they?
Yeah, there's been a huge movement out, particularly from London, but it's also been seen in Manchester, to a certain extent in Bristol, although Bristol's had an influx of people leaving London. But yeah, there's been a massive shift, and not, you know, just to countryside spots, people feeling safer or people realising that they could have more space, or that they need more space if they're going to work from home. But it's the numbers are really big. So I think that will have a real impact on whether people go back to the office or not. Because if you work for a big organisation, you've got some seniority, you can start to set the agenda on this stuff.
So do you not think, to be really creative, say you're trying to write a TV show or something, that's all I can think of at the moment because I'm in that industry. But if you're trying to write a TV show or something, you need to be around people. You're going to get, by the way, I'm just looking this fact up while I was speaking to you there, and it's true. 700,000 people have left London and left Britain because they were from other countries over here working in the hospitality trade. Yeah. And 700,000 people. I mean, it's a massive reset after when we actually come back.
Yeah.
Who's going to fill 700,000 jobs? That's huge.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's it. That's what I think we cannot kind of predict, is that there are some massive shifts, and it'll do things. It might do things to housing prices. You know, it might do things to salaries. Like, there's quite a big, interesting tussle going on between Silicon Valley companies, some of whom have said that they will go remote permanently, and some have said that they'll go hybrid, in terms of what they'll pay their staff. So some are saying, we'll pay you our Silicon Valley rate, even if you live in Houston or, you know, Iowa or whatever, where it's not as expensive as it is in Silicon Valley. And others have said, no, we'll rate your salary dependent on where you are. So if you're in a cheaper area, we're not going to pay you as much. And that'll affect, you know, recruitment and retention for those organizations, because the ones that pay the higher rates will obviously get the better candidates. So, you know, there's all sorts of little tiny shifts that are going to happen along those lines. So it'll be, I think it'll be really interesting to see how it shakes down.
Interestingly, listening to years ago, reading those Tim Ferriss books, was it called The 6-Hour Working Week or The 1-Hour Working Week?
Four, yeah.
Was it four? I was close. Yeah. There you go. He was talking about outsourcing everything then, wasn't it? And that we didn't even have Zoom in those days, outsourcing your accountancy to India and your PA to China or somewhere. You don't even have to be in the same country. It's going to become very strange environment. I remember being in Sri Lanka, and off the back of the tsunami, this guy had set up this hostel for children and also for adults, and in it he'd put this room full of, he bought loads of computers to get people back working and everything, and in it they were just communicating with people all over the world, doing things like you know, PAing and things like that, because they can do it remotely from anywhere and you can keep the prices down. I mean, it's you know,
I have a guy in Nigeria who does some of my transcribing, who I got on a website called, there's one called Upwork, there's another one called Fiverr. And yeah, he does a bit of transcribing for me. It's still not cheap. I pay well, but it's cheaper than it would be in the UK.
What does transcribing mean?
So it's all the, so when, particularly when I did the book, I had about 90 hours of taped interviews that I needed to turn into text. And I'm terrible at that. And I hate it.
All right, who are the interviews with? Let's sell your book a bit here. Who did you interview for the book? What sort of people?
So I interviewed a massive mixture of people, really. Leveson Wood would be one, the explorer who walked the Nile, the TV presenter. Another one, you know, really interesting guy, was a guy who set up Qubits, which is this really high-end spectacle shop. But he had a horrible time of it right at the beginning. So he was really, really raw and honest about how hard he had found being by himself at work had been. And then also loads of academics, so people like Bridget Schulte, who wrote a fascinating book called Overwhelmed, and people at King's Business School, people all over the world, academics from all over the world who specialised in self-employment or solo working. Because basically what I realised when I came to put the book together or came to start thinking about it was that the information was all there about how to cope with this stuff and how to manage it, how our brains work when we're by ourselves, but it wasn't synthesized anywhere. It was all in little silos, academic silos all over the world, and nobody had put it in one place. So that was all I really wanted to do, was just get it in one place.
You mentioned a guy in the book and it escapes me now. I can't remember what company it was, but it's one of those things that you remember from I remember tiny bits from everyone's books and stuff. And you mentioned somebody who was so down on the amount of money he had at the beginning that he went and stuck it on in a casino or something.
Oh yeah, that is that's the beginning of, or I want to say FedEx, but I'm worried that I'm going to get that wrong.
FedEx, it's in your money section. I'm going to quickly skip through, see if I can find it. It was amazing though that they'd done it and
they'd lost almost everything. Yeah, so that section is all about how failure can actually turn out to be something other than failure, and how ideas of success and failure are not that helpful, really. And so yeah, his last roll of the literal dice was to put, I think it was the company's last $5,000 onto the craps table at Las Vegas.
Was it FedEx? I can't remember now. I just remember you talking about it. So in the book,
I'm not sure it was FedEx. I'm worried it wasn't. It was a big. I haven't stupidly. I haven't got a copy of the book. I'm hiding from
good
my
book.
Children.
You should get it. I'm sitting here reading it now.
I mean, I've got about 20 copies, just not in this room.
I've got to be able to see it somewhere. It's only, you know. All right, so let's talk about some of the things then. I mean, one of the big things I find working at home is being lonely.
Yeah,
I mean, that is a real problem. What do you know about that? What can we do to stop that feeling of thinking, oh God, I'm all on my own again every day?
Yeah, it's really difficult. And I mean, the advice is sort of obvious, but incredibly hard to follow, which is that we just have to keep connecting with people. Laurie Santos, who I'm interviewing on my my new podcast, actually, she's a happiness researcher at Yale. And she talks about how happiness is like a tire that needs constantly pumping up. Like, and if you let it just gradually deflate, then you become unhappy, obviously. And so I see connecting with other people as a little inflation. And I've actually got a post-it note stuck to my computer that says, call your friends, because I had got into the habit of just not talking to anybody or telling anybody and anything. And also not asking people how they are. And I think that's the most critical element, is that what we don't understand about loneliness is that by preventing our own loneliness, we can prevent other people's loneliness at the same time. It's a lovely virtuous circle. But I certainly went through a really long period of time where I felt so kind of low and so lonely that I didn't really see any worth in me getting in touch with other people, because what could I possibly bring to the table at that point? Like, I was so meh, basically. And I forgot that they needed me too. Like, I forgot that it was a two-way exchange, and that those friendships weren't just important to me, they were important to the other person as well. So I think that's one of the biggest things to hold in mind for me, is that I have to maintain these other relationships, some of which are within my work and some are outside my work, because I'm important to other people. It's not just that they're important to me. So that's part of it. But you have to build it in. Like, I think one of the massive issues, particularly with the pandemic, but in general, and I wrote about this before the pandemic, with tech, is that we've got so much technology now which steals our opportunities for social connection, like the real ones. And I'm not just talking about social media, but also about the apps that we use to pay invoices, or the fact that you can buy postage on the Royal Mail website now. You don't have to go to the post box. You know, all of those things that would have taken us outside of our homes and into the streets around, possibly into a shop. There's a really fascinating piece of research about people who were forced to have a conversation with the barista who made their cup of coffee in the morning. And there's like a measurable well-being advantage to just having those tiny bits of conversation with real actual humans. And we're so many of those have been taken away from us that we, at the moment particularly, that we have to really, really actively seek them out, like leave the house. And before I knew all of this stuff, I could go for days without really leaving the house. You know, I might take my kids to, you know, school or whatever, but then I would just come and sit with my head down. And I didn't realize that that's massively inefficient as well as lonely, because you don't get much done when you're really unhappy either.
Yeah, I did a podcast on why I was feeling miserable in the first lockdown. And the conclusion we came to was two things. One, we need human contact so badly.
Yeah.
And we were being denied it. And it's a real problem, that, because we are sociable animals, social animals. We like society and we like hanging out with each other. And the other thing was, which is nothing to do with this, which is lack of leadership, as in lack of believable leadership, lack of direction. And we really struggle with it, because it's not someone just going, this is the way forward, we're going to go down this, because everyone was so unsure.
Yeah.
It doesn't fit well with us as humans that we're not being led by, even if they're leading us, you know, over the edge of a cliff, at least we're comfortable with the fact we're going over the edge of a cliff.
Yeah.
And I think because there were so many unknowns with the pandemic and trying to save the economy whilst save lives, it was just an impossible task. And we didn't have the right communication from the top of government saying, well, you know, or the cabinet saying, this is the way we're going, and no one really knew what was happening. So I suppose the pandemic has forced this upon us all. So we've got to learn how to, it's been good, or maybe good practice, but it seems like more of us are going to be working from home. We have the ability to do it. How do you motivate yourself? That is always a problem. I managed to motivate myself to do all these podcasts because I love them.
Yeah.
And that is the big thing for me. But if you don't love your job, how on earth do you look at the TV, look at the kitchen, look at the bedroom, look at the bed and think, I could just go back to sleep, or I'll go and have sex, whichever one you're thinking. You know, there's all these things that you're like going to distract you. What's the key to motivation?
Gosh, that's a huge question, isn't it? I mean, I've always thought that people would say to me when I first went freelance, like, how do you motivate yourself? Like, I would just lie around all the time. And I always want to say, but would you? Like, you might do it for a week. We might do it for 2 weeks. But I think, wouldn't you in the long run either get bored or get scared that you weren't going to bring in any money? Like, I just have to work. I'm not independently wealthy. I don't have an option. So that is one place where my motivation comes from. And obviously, if you're really low, then that is, you know, there are contexts in which it's impossible even to find motivation through a kind of very basic sort of fear. But I also think our brains are great at procrastinating, especially when we're fearful. We constantly muddle procrastination up with fearfulness, and fear can be of success as much as it can be of failure, or it can be that you're about to be revealed. My big one is that I'm about to be revealed as completely incompetent at something, especially things that I've been doing for like 17 years and I'm perfectly competent at, but I still managed to get in a tangle about that. And then that can sap my motivation. But one of the big ways that the research shows that you can get around this stuff is by pre-making decisions which mean that you don't really have to find motivation. And one of those things is really boring, but it's basically having a routine. It doesn't have to be the same routine every day, but just some kind of routine. Because it looks as though we've got a kind of finite amount of willpower every day, and if you can sort of set things up the day before or indeed weeks before, that this is what your day is going to look like, then you don't really have to have that argument with yourself at the beginning of the day, like, am I going to work? Am I not going to work? All you have to do is know that at 10 o'clock in the morning, you start work, or at 11 or 12 or wherever it might be, whatever your schedule is. You've already had that argument with yourself some time ago, and you did it in the past when it wasn't about to happen. So you could kind of put it on your future self, and now your past self made the decision for you. So all that your present self has to do is just follow through, which is sometimes hard, but it's much easier than making the big decision of whether you're going to work or not.
I do this thing. I've read so many books. I can't remember which one it was in, but one of these books I read said, one of a good trick to life is make one decision that gets rid of all the other decisions.
Yeah.
So for instance, which is what you're saying, I start work at 10 o'clock every day, not half past nine or not half past 10, at 10 o'clock. And that just takes that decision and makes you more comfortable. The one I've done, which people will like, and it makes your life such a joy, is I've decided that I will always be the person who lets the other car come down a road. I will always pull in for the other person. I will always be the person who leaves, you know, if you're both about to go through a doorway or something, I will always be the person who lets the other person through. I will always, and then you never get in an argument ever.
And that's so lovely.
You feel amazing about yourself because you never have to make that decision again. You're always the one. And I made that decision after watching someone outside my road. They were 35 minutes. They sat bumper to bumper, refusing to move because they both neither were pulling for each other. And I just thought, that's madness, isn't it? Be the one who always pulls over. And honestly, if you're listening to this and you drive, be that person who always pulls in. Just take
another. I'm going to do that from now on, because I often have a little imaginary argument with myself about, why didn't that person pull in for me? As though I'm actually conversing with the other person, like just in my head. I love that. I think there's so many ways that you can apply that. Some people call it habit stacking, where if you want to create a habit, you find one habit that you already have, and then you attach the habit that you want. So say you want to do, I don't do this, but say you wanted to do yoga every morning, you would do it immediately after you brush your teeth, because brushing your teeth is already habitual. So if you can attach it to something that's habitual, then that habit is much more likely to stick. And then you can just stack habits up and up and up.
I always say to my daughters, whenever I tell them that they should do something, they go, well, I'm not sure I can do that. I say, you brush your teeth every day, you can do that. That's sort of my answer to everything. And when anyone says to Simon Rimmer the other day on the show, and at break went to me, I wish I could play the piano. I went, you can. And he went, no, well, I can't. And I said, well, you can. You just choose not to. So, you know, don't tell me you can't play the piano. You know, you can play the piano, but you have to put a lot of work into it. Now, I'm not sure you have 8 hours a day, but if you did, and you want, you would be playing the piano within a year if you did 8 hours a day. So don't tell me you can't do it. He just looked at me that normal look of like, oh, shut the fuck up. I was just making polite conversation with you in an ad break. I think the other problem with working from home as well, I don't know if there's any research or any tips on this, is the idea that you did of when your hours stop as well. It's so easy to go the other way. You know, we talk about people don't want to start work. The idea that you would carry on working. And interestingly, I've always felt very anxious looking at black cab drivers, because that clock ticks. The longer they stay out, the more money they make. That is a tough call when you're self-employed, when you go home. And I've always hated that theory of the longer I stay out, the more I work, the more money I get. Fortunately, that doesn't work with me. I don't get paid anything for this. And Sunday brunch is the job I do. The mate who I love his job the most is air traffic control. My mate Steve's air traffic control. Nice wage, great thing. But he's told what hours he works, all the decisions taken are off him. He's told how many weeks holiday he gets, which is not bad if I'm honest with you. And they're not allowed to overwork either. But the point he made to me once, and it's always stuck in my mind, when he leaves his job, there's nothing he can do, because you can't land planes via Zoom at home. So when he leaves his job, there's no work. He totally switches off. And I sit at night, like last night I sat and thought, Rebecca, tomorrow pick up a book and start reading it again, because I'm like, there's always something more I can do. That's a problem for us, isn't it?
It's a huge problem. It's called present bias, and it's why it's difficult to start work, and it's why it's difficult to stop work. And it's why I'm always late to collect my children, because we humans just have this present bias. We just think that the present moment, whatever we're in, is the most important one. And it's quite difficult, to greater or lesser extents, depending on the person, to transition from one thing into another. And I think it's one of the things which has been most challenging in the pandemic for people who are homeschooling, is that you have, and I have felt this very profoundly, is that you have this like really abrupt transition. Like today, I homeschooled until 1:30, and then I had like 10 minutes to shift completely into the mode of an adult who's written a book, who can talk about it. You know, it was a really, really abrupt change of gear. So I think we do really struggle with that. The risks of overwork are enormous, and the risks of them to self-employed people are extremely high. But there's a huge amount of research on this. And I think one of the most profound things for all of us to recognize is that if you work too long, your work will suffer. It is not true, apart from for cab drivers, and even then they'll get so tired they crash in the end. But it is not true that longer hours equal more success. That, you know, there's a horrible sort of trope in modern culture where we look at the Jeff Bezos or you know, Beyonce or any of these people who kind of theoretically do 100 hours a week, and we equate their hours with success, and we think that in order to be successful we just have to work incredibly hard as well. And that really doesn't help at the moment, but fundamentally what all the research shows, and like I say there's a lot of it, is that if you start to drift over even 40 hours a week, you begin to negatively impact your productivity. And there's a really fascinating bit of research that was done at Stanford about 10 years ago, which showed that after a certain number of hours, you can actually negatively impact your productivity. It's not just that your productivity goes down, it's that you start to damage the work that you've done before. Wow. You're so knackered that you begin to go into reverse. So it's critical that we get to grips with this idea that long hours equal success, or that long hours should be rewarded. You know, we've got terrible presenteeism culture, particularly in the UK, but also it was much worse in America, slightly less bad in Scandinavia. And at the beginning of the pandemic, I did an article for The Guardian about work, and I interviewed somebody from Deloitte who was like, you know, thinking about this stuff in very kind of big and grand and meaningful ways. And she said, this moment is a moment when we will discover that presenteeism is dead. Like physical presenteeism, she was talking about. So it is no longer going to count for anything about the number of hours that you spend in the office. And even at the time, I thought, I don't think she's right about that, because I'm self-employed and I know how bad presenteeism is, even when nobody watches you. Nobody sees how many hours.
What is that? What do you mean? What does that word mean? Present.
So presenteeism is just literally being at your day. You're present at your desk, right, at your work, or whatever your work is. You're simply present. And the assessment of your worth and your productivity and your success is based on whether you're there. Like, it's based on your hours. It's not really based on anything else. And we've seen there's loads of research showing that historically presenteeism has been rewarded. So you're more likely, if you're more present for longer hours, you're more likely to get career premium. You're more likely to get promotion. You're more likely to be seen positively within the organization that you work for hard work, even if you're not actually doing that well. Even if your productivity isn't that great, you're seen as committed and all of that stuff. And then that stuff is so pervasive that even people who work by themselves, even people who've never worked in big organizations, still take on these ideas, partly because of your Beyoncé's and Jeff Bezos's and Mark Zuckerberg's and all these other people who are rumored to work 100 hours a week. So it all kind of filters down to a point where if you work by yourself, you feel like you should be working incredibly long hours, because that's what we do, that's what people do. And all that's happened in the pandemic is that even though we can't be physically present at our desks in our offices, we're now being digitally present. So we're answering emails really late at night. We're on Slack really late at night. We're on whatever apps, millions of different productivity apps that you can use, or kind of communications app. And we're like waving at the people that we work for or with, saying, I'm here. And people are doing that for loads of reasons, partly because they're fearful of redundancy, partly because there's nothing else to do, so you might as well work. There's that feeling. Partly because organizations have been putting enormous amounts of pressure on people because they're fearful of their future and, you know, all of that stuff. Like, it's a horrible soup of negative stuff, which is going to cause a mental health crisis.
I think there's a shift. I listen to a lot of podcasts about successful people, and there's a shift to busy is unsuccessful.
Good.
And success is delegation and also spending time, you know, having time to think for yourself. And I think there is a definite shift towards that. I really do. And I think the idea that it's funny you were saying about emailing all night long. I think the idea that I'm sending an email at 12 o'clock at night, so everyone must think I'm really busy, I think we'll shift soon towards people saying, why are they doing it at 12 o'clock at night? Why haven't they sorted their life out? You know, yeah. It's like, and I think we're moving towards that. I really do. Let's unpack the success, I think, a little bit before we finish, which is, it's interesting. I have a friend who's a black cab driver. And he told me that he used to work every hour. It's so easy to do when you're young. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, these guys even sleep in their cars. Do you know that? And they work 5 or 6 days in a row, which is quite dangerous, I imagine. Yeah. And they sometimes sleep in their cabs and stuff like that. But he's older now. And he realized he went through a thought process and went, I can't keep doing this. So he worked out a sum of money that would pay for food, mortgage, and a bit to go out and a bit to put away for his holiday every year. And once he hit that, he went home. Then he realized that he actually could just do Thursday, Friday, Saturday shift. And he would get the money in 3 days because that's when people were out, you know, drinking and all that sort of stuff. And he said it was the horrible shift, but he could do all his, and then he had Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday to play golf. And he said he sorted it then, but as soon as Saturday he hit his money, he went home. So he stayed out late Thursday, stayed out late Friday. So he sussed it. And I suppose that was his definition of success, 3 days a week where he could go and play golf. Is that how, when we're looking for success and motivation when we're on our own, is there must be lots of studies and surveys of trying to work out what your actual success is to you?
Yeah. And I think in a way, I don't have a straightforward answer to the kind of what is success question, because it's so individual to everybody. The book as a whole, in a way, is just about asking people to ask questions of themselves and figure out what that looks like. Because what I hadn't done 6 years ago when I was kind of burning out was had any sort of conversation with myself about what I wanted my life to look like what was important, where I wanted to be, how many hours I wanted to work. And so if you want to work really long hours and that really genuinely makes you happy, then great, then that's fine, you know, that's fine. And if having loads of money is genuinely really, really important to you and truly, truly does scratch that itch, then of course that's fine. I think the difficulty comes when you're striving for something which is kind of nebulous. It's just the kind of, you know, a cloudy image of success somewhere further down the track, and it never gets closer. It always moves further away because you're always moving towards it. And then you can have a journey towards this nebulous thing, which is really miserable because you're making loads of sacrifices to get to this kind of mystical place that may not make you happy when you get there anyway, because you haven't really considered what it is or what it looks like. I think the book is about saying, let's please just ask these questions of ourselves. However, the thing I think is really interesting about your black cab driving friend is that he's hit the perfect solution, which is that he's worked out what is enough. And in so many ways, that's where I think we've gone wrong, like, not to be too grand about it, but isn't that the problem globally? I mean, isn't that our issue, is that we have completely lost touch with what enough looks like?
Yeah, we have, because success is based on money. We all look at Jeff Bezos. You know, I don't envy Jeff Bezos at all. He's got a lot of responsibility for what he does with that money. He's going to be judged a lot on what he does with his wealth. And, you know, and also, you know, how much he's putting back into society and tax and everything, which they seem to want to avoid. So he's being judged a lot. So, you know, it's everything, money comes, that much money comes with pressures. By the way, I read a book called The Choice Paradox once. I've read a lot of books and I can sum it up for you. It's a good book, but I can sum it up for you. It's like, if you're always looking for the best, you'll never be happy. If you're looking for that'll do, you'll be happy. That's basically the book. That'll do, then you're happy with it, because you don't put too much on it. All right, we're running out of time, but I just want to quickly ask you about food and drink, because you write about it, obviously, and it's an important thing when you're solo at home, and you can end up, I suppose, just snacking all day long and things like that, can't you?
Yeah, or not eating at all. I was really surprised. Like, I wrote a chapter about food and drink in the book because, and I wasn't planning to, but I went on a few Facebook groups for people who work by themselves and said, you know, what should I put in the book? Like, what would you like to get answers to? And everybody came back, well, not everybody, but most people came back saying, how do I not eat just toast? Like, how do I not live on Cheerios? How do I not eat everything in the fridge? And I was like, what? Is that really the problem? And it just turned out that, yeah, it was a massive problem, was that people were just either eating really crap food or no food, like refusing to stop at all because they felt they just had to power through, somebody sent me a picture a few weeks ago. It was like literally she was eating her children's breakfast leftovers at midday as her lunch.
We've all been there.
I've never done that for an actual meal. I mean, I will graze on my children's leftovers, don't get me wrong, I like a fish finger, but like, I don't know. I just think when you're by yourself, you deserve to eat well just as much as you do any other time. And you need to as well. And taking time out in your working day to have a break, which really kind of decouples your brain away from work, has been shown in loads of studies to help you get the work done better, faster, later, so that you can get away from work again. Yeah. You know, it stops work expanding to fill every corner of your life when you take proper breaks and you give yourself a real moment. So there's loads on my Instagram at Bex Seal of one person 15 minute meals, because every time I make one for myself, I take a picture and explain the recipe, because I just really want people to know that you don't have to eat what my mum used to eat when she worked by herself, which was two pieces of dry bread from a sliced loaf in a packet and some ham. That was it. No spread.
Nothing wrong with that. That's a good meal. I like it. Stick some mayo in it and you've got a...
No, she had nothing.
Gourmet sandwich. All right, three quick questions. I try and keep this within an hour or around an hour. Three quick questions, so quick answers. What's one piece of advice that's been invaluable to your life?
Try not to care so much about what everybody else thinks of you. It's like
that's in the book.
It is.
I remember that bit.
It's a continual battle. I mean, I'm in therapy at the moment because my anxiety went like out of the ceiling during last year, and I decided it would be a good idea to get a handle on that. And I'm still working on it. I'm nearly 40, and I'm still working on this thing that I've been told since I was 13.
Yeah, you say in your book, and I agree. I can't remember the exact words, but everyone on social media is a bullshitter, basically. sort of the gist of it, and it's true, especially if you go on Facebook. I mean, like, I'm coping so well. Go fuck yourself. You know, it's like, no, you're not. And it's like, you know, everybody's coping better than everybody else. I don't believe it. That's just a cry for help.
It's curated. So, it's all we put our bits up. We don't, as I said in the book, we don't take pictures of ourselves weeping at midnight over our, you know, bits of work that we haven't finished properly or whatever it might be. Like, we just don't, or rows, or...
Yeah. Too much social media is, oh, feel sorry for me, or I'm so much better than you. It's one or the other. It swings backwards and forwards. What's the meaning of life?
I interviewed someone who said this really well a couple of days ago. I'm going to try and nick it off her. Be joyful. Just find joy in stuff. She said it much better than me.
It's not very catchy.
Put it on a t-shirt. Basically, I don't really believe in any...
joyful, joyous, just find joy.
I don't believe in any of the stuff about kind of us having a purpose or kind of, you know, a higher purpose or the universe or any of that stuff. I just think let's just be here, be present, and try and find as much joy in it as we can. And that sounds like an Instagram aphorism, doesn't it? I'm not a very profound person.
I like it. Well, you just said you interviewed someone there. What's your podcast? Was that where you're interviewing them?
Yes. Yeah. Thank you. It's going to be called The Solo Collective, and it launches in March. And it's basically conversations about solo working. But yeah, it's definitely...
Brilliant. Is that available in all the usual podcast places and some unusual ones too?
Yeah. anywhere, literally find me anywhere. Yeah, 18th of March, I think, is the current launch date.
Lovely to speak to you, Rebecca. And Solo, How to Work Alone and Not Lose Your Mind is out now. And you send people to your Instagram. Is that where you want them to go to contact with you?
At Bex Seal, BexSeal, or my website is howtoworkalone.com.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Rebecca.
Thank you for having me.
The Lovejoy Hour is written and presented by Tim Lovejoy, produced by Blake Fellows, and sponsored by Quooker. If you want to get in touch, email lovejoyhour@gmail.com or you can find Tim on Twitter and on Instagram.